welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back, and it is now or never, and this is day three of covering Hamilton's plan. Now, it's a few pages, but there's a lot of, I guess, editorializing and or questions and so forth. And I understand that this is kind of difficult. It's not just straight. It's not a story like Jack and Jill ran up the hill. This is definitely Madison explaining what Hamilton did and what he stated during the Constitutional Convention. And so I'm going to retrace some of this. But before I do, because I want to get this done today, I want to wrap up Hamilton's plan today. That way we can actually take more of a topical approach regarding Madison's notes on the Constitution, because on the Constitutional Convention, because what I want to do is I want to pull out how they evolved in talking about electors. And when I say electors, there are two instances or two inferences. One is the people, the voter, and I shouldn't say the people, it's actually the voter. The voter is the person that has the authority or the allowance by government. In other words, you've paid your tax. You are a property owner. You're not just some person that came here. To be clear, you had to be a U.S. citizen to own property and to be able to vote. And those were basically synonymous, just so you understand that. Now, Madison is, you know, kind of capturing this, and he's not saying too much other than really, I mean, you'd think that he would be putting a spin or, you know, how he disagreed or what have you. There's no doubt in my mind he was kind of shocked by some of the stuff and by what's coming up and what he's already started saying about invoking a monarchy, a British form of monarchy with a parliament which is limited and a monarch, a president that has the energies. Anyway, let's get into what he says here. Let the executive also be for life. He appealed to the feelings of the members present whether a term of 7 years would induce the sacrifices of private affairs, which, on acceptance of public trust, would require so as to ensure the service of the best citizens. On this plan, we should have in the Senate a permanent will, a weighty interest, which would answer essential purposes. But this is a Republican government, it will be asked. Yes, if all the magistrates are appointed and vacancies are filled by the people. Now, I go back to, because I didn't get a chance to highlight this, because the other day Paul said, hey, GR, you seem to attack, every time the word magistrate comes up, you seem to attack this. Now, look at what they're saying, and who is he referring to as the magistrates? The legislators. And as a matter of fact, this particular group of magistrates are the Senate. Because that's what he says. On this plan, we should have a Senate, a permanent will, a weighty interest which would answer essential purposes. But this is a Republican government, it will be asked. Yes, if all the senators or magistrates are appointed and vacancies are filled by the people or a process of election originating with the people. He was sensible that an executive constituted as he proposed would have, in fact, now he's talking about he, Hamilton, was sensible that an executive constituted as Hamilton proposed would have, in fact, but little the power and independence that might be necessary. On the other plan of appointing him for 7 years, Hamilton thought that the executive ought to have power, but little. Hamilton would be, or the president or the executive would be, because he uses he interchangeably here. So you have to wonder if this Hamilton, in this case, no. The executive would be ambitious with the means of making creatures. And as the object of ambition would be to prolong his power, it is probable that in case of a war, the executive would avail himself to the emergence or the urgency or the emergency, you know, the crisis would prolong or would evade or refuse a degradation from his place, from his position as the executive. An executive for life has not this motive for forgetting his fidelity and will therefore be a safer depository of power. It will be objected probably that such an executive will be an elective monarch and will be and will give birth to the tumults which characterize that form of government. Now, I know I've already read this, but I wanted to kind of highlight and emphasize some of this stuff as we kind of move forward. If this executive magistrate, now we've got a different magistrate. See, they're just covering everybody. They call judges magistrates, the executives magistrate, the magistrate. But truly, the magistrate with power is the legislative, because they're the ones that create the law, change the law, and or obliterate law. They have that power. The executive, when you look at the delegated powers, the executive has the ability to work with foreign nations, so he's a magistrate on foreign affairs. I mean, he has the ultimate say on that. So he's the sovereign regarding our foreign relations, but he can't declare war. So in other words, when you look at the concept of magistrate, it is just a bad concept. It is a concept that gets people to think that we have kings or we, you know, that all of this power. Technically, there is a delegation of sovereignty where even the judges have a level of sovereignty. As long, and there's these caveats, a judge only has sovereignty over a case that he has won jurisdiction and standing, or that the case has jurisdiction for his court and standing. And he cannot redefine law. He has to go to the legislature to be able to do that. And if it is something that the legislature, it's already been defined, even the legislature can't redefine law. They're required to go back to the states and say, you know, the law, we've defined the law as this. And now in the age of computers, technology, and blah, 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 we believe that the law needs to be expanded and we need your assistance in defining this. We need you to define what we're supposed to do. See, that is what our government is supposed to do. But instead, everybody just assumes the power. They just do what they feel is necessary to get it done, and they move us down the road. And this is how this ambitious government had slowly and quickly started creeping outside of these, out of its containment from the Constitution. It actually began with Hamilton as the Secretary of the Treasury. It also happened with Marshall as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It also happened with John Adams and Congress, you know, as well. I mean, so Congress, you know, was constantly doing these things. And the only reason why they were getting away with it is because even then the people were illiterate regarding the roles, responsibilities, and powers regarding that Constitution and what they could do. They literally had the people gave them blind trust. Anyway, as I move back, if this executive magistrate would be a monarch for life, the other proposed by the report from the Committee of the Whole would be a monarch for 7 years. The circumstance of being elective was also applicable to both. It had been observed by judicious writers that elective monarchs would be the best if they could guard against the tumults excited by the ambitions and intrigues of competitors. you know, there's always those levels of politics. He was not sure that the tumults were an inseparable evil. Hamilton rather thought this character of elective monarchies had been taken rather from particular cases, rather from general principles. The election of Roman emperors was made by the army. In Poland, the election was made by rival princes and independent power, an ample means of raising commotions. In the German Empire, the appointment is made by the electors and the princes. Now, the voters and the subordinate monarchs, right? You know, because you have all of the families. And, you know, they're all going to vote by, so apparently in Germany it was a little bit different, who have equal motives and means for exciting cabals and parties. Might not such a mode of election be devised among ourselves as will defend the community against these effects in any dangerous degree? Having made these observations, Hamilton would read to the committee a sketch of a plan which he shared, which he should prefer to either of those other under consideration. Hamilton was aware that it went beyond the ideas of most members, but will such a plan be adopted out of doors? In return, he would ask, will the people adopt the other plan? At present, they will adopt neither, but he sees the union dissolving or already dissolved, and Hamilton sees evil operating in the states, which must soon cure the people of their fondness for democracies. Hamilton sees that a great progress has already been made and is still going on in the public mind. Hamilton thinks, therefore, that the people will, in time, be shackled from their prejudices, and whether that happens, they will themselves not be satisfied at stopping where the plan of Mr. Randolph would place them, but be ready to go as far, or at least as he proposes. Hamilton did not mean to offer the paper he had sketched as a proposition to the committee. It was meant only to give a more correct view of his ideas and to suggest the amendments which he should propose, which he, Hamilton, should probably propose to the plan of Mr. Randolph in the proper stages of its future discussion. Then Hamilton read his sketch for the words following, to wit. First, the supreme legislative power of the United States shall be vested in two different bodies of men, the one to be called the Assembly, the other the Senate, who together shall form the legislature of the United States, Congress, with power to pass all laws whatsoever subject to the negative hereafter mentioned. Two, the assembly to consist of persons elected by the people to serve for 3 years. Electors, three, and so this is where we actually have electors being discussed in better detail. The Senate, and this has nothing to do with the Electoral College yet. The Senate to consist of persons elected to serve during good behavior. Their election be made by electors chosen for that purpose by the people. In order to this, the states be divided into election districts. In other words, the states weren't going to stand. The state governments were going to be divided up into districts. On the death, removal, or resignation of any senator, his place to be filled out of the district from which he came. Four, the extreme executive, the supreme executive, authority of the United States to be vested in a governor to be elected to serve during good behavior. The election is to be made by electors chosen by the people. So this is the first insight. This is the first time that I know of where they actually use electors with a capital E that is actually a representative by the people who will choose the president. So voila, we have finally on page 80 of 466, we actually see the first hint of the Electoral College. In the election districts aforesaid, the authorities, or so let me just repeat that. The supreme executive authority of the United States to be vested in a governor, not a president, to be elected to serve during good behavior, the election to be made by electors, chosen by the people in the election district aforesaid. The authorities and functions of the executive to be as follows: to have a negative on all laws about to be passed and the execution of all laws, to have the direction of war when authorized or begun, to have the advice and approbation of the Senate the power of making all treaties, and to have the sole appointment of the heads, chiefs, and officers of the departments of finance, war, and foreign affairs. State, Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, and the Department of Defense. To have the nominations of all other officers, ambassadors to foreign nations included, subject on the approbation, rejection of the Senate, to have the power of pardoning all offenses except treason, which he shall not pardon without the approbation of the Senate. 5, on the death, resignation, or removal of the governor, his authorities to be exercised by the president of the Senate till a successor be appointed. 6, the Senate to have the sole power of declaring war, the power of advising and approving all treaties, and the power of approving or rejecting all appointments of officers except the heads or chiefs of the Departments of Finance, War, and Foreign Affairs. 7, the supreme judicial authority to be vested in judges to hold their offices during good behavior. Now, it's interesting, I haven't heard the judges be referred to as magistrates, but today we do. We call them magistrates. Why? this court to have original jurisdiction in all cases of capture and an appellate jurisdiction in all cases which the revenues of the general government or the citizens of foreign nations are concerned. 8, that the legislature of the United States to have the power to institute courts in each state for the determination, and he's calling them states, but he said that they're to be divided by districts. And so there's an inconsistency here. Let me just point out the obvious. The determination of all matters of general concern. 9, the governor, senators, and all officers of the United States to be liable to impeachment for mal and corrupt conduct, and upon conviction to be removed from office and disqualified for holding any place of trust or profit. All impeachments to be tried by a court to consist of the chief or judge of the superior court of law of each state, provided such judge shall hold his place during good behavior and have a permanent salary. Now, it's interesting. He says that the court to consist of the chief judge or judge of the superior court of law of each state. So, in other words, you're to have a chief justice of each state. Now, interestingly enough, I'm going to go down a rat hole on this. And so as we look at a Republican form of government, one of the most critical things, one of the things we actually have to consider, because as we look at the three branches of government, there's representation of the people in the presidency by the electors. The people choose our electors, and our electors are to choose who is to be president. And we choose our electors, and our electors are to choose who is to be vice president, not the parties. The parties do not determine who the president and vice president, you know, who will fill what office. That is for the electors and the electors alone to choose. Now, as we look at, you know, Congress, it's a no-brainer. The state legislature is to appoint the senators, even though the 17th Amendment has perverted that. But we, the people, have our representation in the House of Representatives. Now, when we look at the court, and we look at the size of the court and how many members of the court existed, you know, they had, you know, I need to do the due diligence. And I guess during the break, we're about 4 minutes out. So during the break, I'm going to go do the due diligence, and I'm going to go look at who the first members of the Supreme Court were. And I want to point this out, that they felt that they needed a quorum of judges to be of a certain size to accommodate 13 states. Why would the judges, why would the court not grow in perspective, or I should say in association to the growth of the union? Are we a republican form of government? And is our court and our law system republican in form as well? What I mean, folks, and I believe that this is something that we really should look at as making our justice system far less contemptible and far less corrupt. Because if the old adage, a friend of mine always said, keep it small, keep it all. And so if you keep it small, and as a matter of fact, if you make it so that the elite institutions, the Ivy League law centers, will actually have control. And so whoever controls the Ivy League law centers will actually have, you know, that influence on our laws and our judgments. I believe that the Ivy League should have no influence on our laws and judgment. I believe that the states, if we're Republican in form, I believe that the people, the counties, and the states are those things that should have influence over our government, not an education system for profit, not an education system that actually can be weaponized and actually undermine us. And so this is where ideas are taken into a petri dish and baked and tested and constantly played with and engineered and managed, and why our entire justice system has been engineered by the elite Ivy Towers. So my consideration or my proposal is that the Chief Justice be appointed by the president and lives, or I should say operates, during the term of the president. If there is an equality of the justices of the state and the Chief Justice, in other words, if you have 49 states and one Chief Justice, then the president will actually pick a alternate or an inferior Chief Justice, where the president picks who will be the honcho of the court and who will be the vice honcho of the court. And the rest of the court, the composition of the court, would be the Chief Justice of every state. In other words, it's not a federal position, it's a state position. And it is maintained kind of like Congress. It's representative of the state, and we have to, it's only been proven with empirical data where these men are going to tell us through the notes of Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, as well as when we listened to the Federalist Papers, as well as the ratification debates, everybody tells us that the court system will be immune if our judges are, you know, lifetime positions based on good behavior. That's only been proven wrong. As a matter of fact, I believe we have a better government that is based on the law, and that we have oversights and checks and balances so that judges can't create law, they can't redefine law, and they can't go down these paths of agendas in inflicting and actually perverting our government, as we have seen, which is exactly what the judges have done. They have been more instrumental in perverting our rule of law, our constitution, and our form of government. And they should not have that power. And anyway, We're going into break. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I want you to think about this, because I believe that we would be far more protected, because bottom line, folks, we have a responsibility to hold our judges in line with the Constitution. In other words, they've been immune from this, and they've been able to get away with murder, literally. I mean, it was a judge and a court that voted to allow abortion, where the states should have been able to quickly interpose. But the problem is that the states never understood what Madison and Jefferson did. And so until the plan of Republic Review was exposed, and this concept of the states having direct intervention, there's no reason why, folks, we live in an age of being able to intervene in bad government. You know, back in the days where the effort to intervene, you had to get on a horse, and it took time and a lot of effort. And you had to be able to project this and communicate this. By the time, you know, in the early 1800s, when we had, what, let's say 20 states in the Union, to get the word out in the early 1800s, it was just as arduous, just as difficult as it was in the 1789, when our government formed. It was, you know, you had to get on a horse, you had to ride all over, you had to basically help everybody understand. And the ability to take all that content and the ability to actually help everybody profoundly understand what the real problems were, so that they could effectually interpose enforcing the government into compliance, was almost impossible. They didn't have the ability, which is why it was so important to send people that understood what they were supposed to do and not allow, you know, basically make sure that they weren't going to allow compromise and usurpations. But they did anyway. And then people, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Madison had already given us the process that one by one we had to interpose on each of these principles. Oh, but that seemed like it was just so hard, almost impossible, to get everybody informed in a timely manner. We don't have these excuses anymore, folks. There's no more excuses. As a matter of fact, when you start empowering the people to a point to create and maintain, well, actually, we were given a very pristine government. The divine hand of providence ensured that we had a very pristine government that was basically, incorruptible. When you understand what our government really means and all of the bits and pieces, all the nuts and bolts to our government, we the people had a responsibility to petition our government every time it creeped, it leaned, it looked outside the boundaries of the Constitution. We had the right to petition them for the redress of grievances. How dare you think about going there? Don't even think about it. I mean, that was the power that we had. The only problem is we didn't have the ability to actually execute Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, because that didn't exist until the 1867, 1868, when it was ratified. So now that we have that, now that we have all of this power and ability, why is it we're not organizing and unifying in demanding full compliance of the Constitution? What's our excuse now? I'm telling you, folks, we have the most important response. Our responsibility is keeping our government in check. And if we're not doing that, then you can't complain about government out of control if you're not keeping it in check. And the Constitutional Convention is not the process. The Constitutional Convention is a way of distributing or delegating more power, taking power away, or actually fixing a deficiency in the Constitution, changing a role and responsibility, but it is not there to hold them accountable. The First Amendment petition is the only process for the redress of grievances. And if they fail, there are teeth to this. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment demands that they be removed. So how is it that we're going to enforce this? Oh, an Article 5 convention. Well, it says you're supposed to be removed, so you got to be removed. It's stupid. It's like saying, well, the 10th Amendment says that you can't do anything that's not delegated, so don't do anything that's not delegated. That's stupid. We don't need to reiterate what is actually clear and concise. What we have to do is we have to enforce it. And it is very clear that when we, the people, demand that our public servants enforce the law and make it so, what has to happen? Because the law is clear. Section 3 of the 14th is clear. Any person who has taken the oath of office and while under that oath violates that by, one, actually directly violating the Constitution and not supporting it, where it is not supporting it, it's violating it, or failing to stop somebody who has violated the Constitution. If you just sit on your hands and you don't say, hey, I don't think you can do that. Hey, I know you can't do that. You don't just vote against it. This is why I have an absolute problem with the state legislator Republicans, you know, whether that's in Washington state or what state out there, that they're just voting against something when somebody is actually, and I'll give you a good case in point, the digital currency bills or these taking of parental rights. Any public servant that votes for a bill that violates the Constitution directly violates the Constitution, whether it's the Ninth Amendment, whether it's Article 1, Section 10, where they're passing a bill that allows anything other than gold and silver coin to be the legal tender for the payment of debt. In other words, these digital currency bills was a direct violation against the Constitution, actually committed by those who voted for that bill. Therefore, the job and duty for everybody else that said, no, you can't do this, shouldn't have been just voting against it. Should have actually been a petition to demand that these people who violated their oath of office be removed because of what they just did. And as far as I'm concerned, if they're not doing that, and if your county commissioners are not doing that, then they're equally culpable. And we got to get rid of all of them. And so I can't emphasize enough how important it is for this system to function. We the people, because as we were kind of pointing out, this whole point of energy, you know, there are literally two movements here, folks. There are a bunch of people, because Hamilton talked about this. You know, when there is a sentiment and a movement, it can actually topple governments. Or it can save governments. Quit being misled and quit being confused. Now, if you feel otherwise, by all means, just call us on our comment line. It's a 202 number. It's right there on our webpage. Go ahead and give us a call. Leave a comment and say, how dare you be so disparaging with the John Birch Society and their nullification plan, or the 10th Amendment Center, John Birch Society, and the Eagle Forum? How dare you? I dare. And I'll go through it again, because we just went through it in December. I go through this yearly, folks. How many times do I have to repeat myself? And as a matter of fact, one of my favorite King Crimson lines, I repeat myself when under stress. I repeat myself when under stress. I repeat myself when under stress. Are you getting it? We are definitely under stress. And we're definitely in a position where we have to repeat the truth over and over because for some reason, it's not sinking in. People are yelling, wake up. And most of the people, almost all of the people yelling, wake up, are actually, they have an agenda to mislead you. What we have to do is we have to unite on demanding full compliance of the Constitution. And we must interpose one way or the other, whether it be by the ballot box at the county level, and we start severing our elections, we start severing, you know, the ability for influence to come from on high. We want to make sure that our county representatives are not in our election system that the state and federal government control. We need to sever these things. This is why we're working on a petition to do this. Unfortunately, the guy that helps me has got a good job and he's traveling all over the place on that one particular petition. So we're just having a heck of a time trying to get this done. But anyway, back to Hamilton and what he's been saying here, because he was just, I'll just repeat number 9. That the governor, senators, and all offices of the United States shall be liable for impeachment or malfeasant corrupt conduct. Again, other than the president and vice president, holding people accountable for failing to live up to their oath has been replaced in the Constitution by Section 3. There are no law. It's not an impeachment process. It's not even a due process. You don't even have the right to appeal in court. It is an eligibility. It's kind of like, folks, if your governor moves out of your state while he's still your governor, he is instantly, the day he takes residence in another state, he is instantly ineligible to be your governor. Do you need to take him to court? No. He has moved out. You now have to institute whoever the backup plan or the succession plan is that you have in your state government in replacing the governor who is no longer ineligible. His pay stops that day, whatever. And there are times and reasons for them maybe to move. But you can't retain or maintain your position in office if you're not following the criteria that's required for that office. And in the Constitution, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the supreme law of the land, it states that while in office and you fail to support the Constitution or attack those who are insurrecting against it, then you are not eligible to be in office. You're gone. And you are to be banned for life. That's the big difference. Between, you know, you moving out of state, you're not banned for life from being a governor or being a public servant anymore. But when you commit perjury, then you've now committed a crime. And you're not being fined. You're not being thrown in jail. There's no life, liberty, or anything like that. You've lost your emolument and your access to emoluments ever again. And the only way, and it's right there in the Constitution, the only way that disability or that ineligibility for you to ever be in office again can be lifted requires 2/3 of both houses of Congress to actually vote and lift that from you. So, and most people go, oh, well, Congress, they're so corrupt. I'm telling you, once we start cleaning out Congress, and let me ask you this. When you actually get somebody into office that has just replaced a corrupt person, and you've done this to a lot of people, and you actually have this movement where we actually have full control over Congress, where we're demanding full compliance, every person in Congress that is in your state is demanding compliance of the Constitution. They finally get it. They finally understand this model that the supreme law is the law. It is our king. And therefore, do you really think that they're going to actually allow a corrupt person to actually run for office again or to come back and take their place? Folks, that's antithetical to a person sitting in a position of emoluments. I mean, I don't know anybody that actually steps down and says, yeah, take your place back. I mean, you know, I feel sorry for you. No. You did this to yourself. You're not coming back here. And they won't even vote to give you your honor back. And I believe that's the direction that our society has to go. You've lost that honor and privilege. It should be a lot. You have to really prove that you've learned your lesson and that you will live the law. That society is the society we could obtain. We just need to understand it and how to maintain it. And it's not rocket science, folks. It literally isn't rocket science. So anyway, I editorialized again. Let me get back to number 10. All laws of the particular states, contrary to the Constitution, are laws of the United States to be utterly void. And the better, and actually that should be happening now. There should be no state that's allowed to take parental rights. There should be no state that allows anything that is a violation of the Constitution. And the better to prevent such laws being passed, the governor or president of each state shall be appointed by the general government and shall have a negative upon the laws about to be passed in the state of which he is governor or president. In other words, Hamilton is actually embracing the concept of the king when he replaced the governors and the government of the states when he had to. And instead, he liked that so much, he wanted to invoke that control. Wow. I mean, I'm just wondering what was flying through, because Madison is not actually capturing the sentiments of everybody, the looks on their faces, you know, and their responses, because you know how people are. If you've ever watched a movie, you go to the movies, and if you're in the front row and you stand up or you start to get up, but you're not blocking anybody, or you're standing on the side and you're looking at the faces, you can see how everybody in unison is emotionally responding to what's happening on that screen. You can't help it. It's human nature. I mean, there will be some people that may be very stoic because they're less expressive. But I'm telling you, you will see the power of the medium of a movie. You will see the power of the reaction of people to the medium of something, whether it's a presentation or whether it's a movie. Now, movies are far more powerful because you were far more susceptible to, you know, the realness of life. You know, when somebody's just up there telling you a story, when somebody's just presenting something, you know, it's not the same. So that's why I say the danger of movies and that medium of how we can be conditioned. As a matter of fact, I pointed this out to a friend. Forgive me for going down this rat hole, but remember the China Syndrome and how that one movie created a panic and fear that gripped America over the dangers of a nuclear power facility, right? And so there are these movies that actually can, you know, rip through the culture or the fabric of our society. And so there was the China Syndrome, and there was this other one. I forget, Meryl Streep was exposed to radiation. You know, we had those types of movies that caused and helped amplify fear. We've also had movies over the past several decades preparing us to be destroyed from space. You know, Independence Day. I mean, look at, you know, as a matter of fact, go out and look at the movies that are in production and actually available. You can download them. Look for 2024, 2025, you know, destruction, apocalypse, and those types of movies. And you'll be amazed that there's that many of them. Why? Because we've been conditioned to be prepared to fight and to take on this evil destruction that is coming towards us. What does the Bible say? Well, the Bible says that the world will take up arms when Christ comes. And do you think he's going to be coming from the center of the earth, or do you think he'll be coming from the heavens? Folks, we're being conditioned to do the devil's bidding right here in America. And so I'm here to tell you that our real fear is not following the law. Because if we're not following the law, then we are being tossed to and fro. And as a matter of fact, I'm okay with the freedom of the, you know, expression of arts and the movies and those types of things. But they, I'm not okay with them inflicting them upon people that have no maturity, such as our children. I'm okay with these types of controls. As a matter of fact, I don't understand why .xxx never got fielded. Folks, anything of adult nature on the internet should have actually been masked by a .xxx. And then you could easily set your computer up not to allow any adult, you know, content that had that. So that it, because it hides in the .coms and .orgs and .us and .net, that pernicious pornography, and you make it illegal. You go after the institutions that are running any of that stuff. And yeah, there'll be the underground or the wire or what have you, because people are going to want it. They need to get to your kids somehow. But when we make the consequences so severe, I mean, that's all we have to do, folks. You know, stealing a person's horse was so unacceptable that if you steal a horse, you die. You be hanged. Period. We have to make consequences very, very clear. I already talked about the consequences of bankruptcy and, you know, how we've just completely, we're missing this, and we're allowing the government to play us left and right because we don't want to be severe. You know, that's the problem. As a matter of fact, you spank a child, then the government has stepped in and said, you can't do that anymore. Well, that means that your government is actually passing laws on telling you how to raise a child. And that is not acceptable. They have no control over the children. As a matter of fact, if it's not enumerated in the federal constitution and it's not enumerated in your state constitution that the state can tell you how to raise your child, it's maybe something that your county might have laws of how to act and behave. But if that's why it's important to even have a county constitution, then nobody can come along and tell you you can't reprimand your child. And now we actually have children that are learning respect. They're learning to not be rude, respectful, and courteous, and so forth. This is why we have our mores are going down the toilet. Anyway, number 11. I'm almost done here, folks. No state to have any forces, land, naval, and the militia of all states to be under the sole exclusive direction of the United States, the officers of which to be appointed and commissioned by them. And I've got to highlight this because, you know, here are presentations of ideas and plans where the federal government would have all these full controls. They didn't get this. But yet they do. Where's your militia today, folks? You don't have a militia. You don't. The National Guard is a federal enforcement agency that is permanently stood up, and it is not under the state and county governments. But they had to basically decimate the county and state government powers. And the Dick Act was the actual one of the big signs that the federal government had actually accomplished that. And when was the Dick Act passed? 1903. And not one state stood up and said, you can't do this. And therefore, it seemed like the states accepted unconstitutional law, but it is still unconstitutional to this day. And we have the power to hold everybody accountable to all of the once a violation, it's always a violation. There is no statute of limitations within the Constitution that says, oh, well, if we can get away with doing this for 100 years, then it's legitimate. Sorry, folks, that's not in there either. Nor is it in there that states that, oh, well, you know, if we think it's okay and it's for the betterment, you know, it's for the good of all. That's not in there either. We have enumerated powers in our constitutions. They are limited and defined. And that is why it is so important to understand that one aspect and that one thing. Anyway, so in conclusion here, we're actually concluding Hamilton's plan. This is his last statement. This is Madison kind of summarizing his last statement. On these several articles, Hamilton entered into explanatory observations. So these articles from 1 to 11, Hamilton went through and basically made these explanations to help highlight and illuminate what these things were going to do and how they would function and so forth. Corresponding with the principles of his introductory, and basically he was tying these to his initial reasoning of why we need this kind of government versus the other two presented by the New Jersey plan as well as the Virginia plan. And so at this point, Hamilton had taken up the whole day, and the committee rose and the House adjourned. And ergo, the end of the Hamilton plan. And on Tuesday, the 19th, they actually come back, and I think they actually start, you know, going, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And as a matter of fact, Madison comes back. And so what we're going to do when we come back is we're going to actually basically read this diatribe from Madison. And as a matter of fact, I'm still going through this. And I'm going to tell you how many pages this is because it's a lot. So Madison responds in kind to Hamilton, and he actually puts a lot in here. And so that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 and a half pages. I mean, it's equal to, if not a little bit more, and that's not even a full day. Then Wilson responds, and Hamilton, and as I understand it, it was shortly after Hamilton presented this plan that he basically left the convention. He got up on his horse. He left. I mean, he adjourned himself, not the committee, but he actually just said, "Okay, I'm leaving. I got to go back to New York." And he went out, and you know, he kind of huffed. Got out on like a little indolent child and just had a little tantrum, went out, got on his horse, and rode back to New York. For whatever reason, he just couldn't be in the room anymore, because I'm sure that there was a plethora of criticism, and I'll just say Hamilton was probably the brunt of a lot of jokes. But he came back. And he worked with these people, and he still had his disdain for the system, but he went ahead with it and said, okay, but we'll actually find some of those comments later. But anyway, I'm hoping that you start to see how Hamilton was actually presenting a plan that I believe, as this alleged spy for Britain, I believe that this is what he was induced to do. And with that, I'm J.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.